You are listening to Sheep Might Fly, a podcast of serialised fiction written and read by Tansy Rayner Robbins. Our current serial is Curse of Bronze. This is kind of the last chapter. There will be an epilogue, which will be appearing on the podcast not next week, but the week after, because I'm taking a break for Easter. Then after the serial is finished, there will be a brief historical interlude. More about that later. And then I'll be starting the new serial later in April, which is my long-awaited Jane Austen with Dragons novella. Not actual Jane Austen, though not Jane Austen, as you will see. But for now, we're on Curse of Bronze, Chapter 10, A Tale of Two Tomb Raiders. "Obviously we couldn't be expected to wait until morning," said Tag Gardner, taking a healthy sip of whiskey from his port glass. "Hold up," said Colin. "That's not where it started. 700 years ago, the demons of stone and metal left the world of flesh." "If you take us all the way back to the demon age, I will bite you," said Bella. "Ah," said Colin, "you're the youngest sibling, aren't you? You remind me of me." "The demon age is important," agreed Tag, "but you can't start there. See, 300 years earlier..." "No," said Bella sternly. "Save it for publication." "Fine, we'll get through that part quickly," said Colin. "The Artemisian Empire was formed from the abandoned monster kingdoms. Demons left, vampires and werewolves and wood nymphs and all those other magical races stuck around. Fine. Empire fell apart. Republic took its place. Spin on to 50 years ago, when Apollonia seceded from the rest of Artemisia." "Is that part really relevant?" Tag interrupted. "Also, it was 55 years ago." Bella coughed. "It was 80 years ago," she corrected, feeling quite apologetic. "Oh, hell," said Colin, looking very pale. "It is, isn't it? Just add 25 years to literally everything I say from now on." "I think what my esteemed colleague is trying to say," said Tag, "is that for the first 50 years or so of independence, Apollonia was very insular and sensitive about anything to do with the study of monsters and monstrous history, because all that was so closely associated with Artemisia. So, their development of history and archaeology was way behind, and when they started finally getting a bit more open-minded about all things monster, they reached out to..." "Sorry, why is everyone wincing when I say the word monster?" "It's not a very acceptable term these days," said Lionel, flashing his sharp teeth. "At least, not in the mouth of humans." "They can say it, we can't," explained Bella. "You have werewolf brothers. You should know better," Selwa chided Tag. "It wasn't all that nice to say 25 years ago, either."
"But it's our academic specialty."
"Never mind. Okay." "There was grant money up for grabs," said Colin. "For Artemisian archaeologists to partner with Apollonians and increase our shared knowledge of, can I say, demonic history?" There was a general agreement around the table this was an acceptable term. "The point," said Tag heavily, "is that we got competitive, him and me." Selwa snorted. "This part sounds familiar." "We knew we'd do better to build a larger team," Colin went on. "You needed to prove you had independent funding to be up for the grant. Our head of department told us flat out that only one team from each university should apply, and we had to suck it up and work together on our proposal. But we still had to find some way to beat each other, obviously." "Obviously," sighed Tag. They shared a rueful expression. "We were both so worked up about being forced to be friendly. We ended up getting hammered down the local pub and made a bet on who could raise the most funds. To make it fair, we decided to prove we were better than the rest of them by basing our dig proposal on the most spurious piece of evidence we could find," sighed Colin. "And that was how we chose the grotesque glossary."
"It didn't even look like a real map," complained Tag.
You basically have to be half cut and staring at it sideways to see a realistic coastline. But the joke got away from us. Gardner convinced every museum in Lyceum to chip in towards our setup costs, Collins said heavily. Hathaway charmed Julian Quinfield, last great-grandson or whatever of Lord Scribbles in his sleep, out of a giant wedge of his trust fund, to prove the grotesque language wasn't a hoax, said Tag. We weren't looking for some whacking great tomb full of dead pharaoh, you understand. All we needed was a crumb of proof that some mad old codger hadn't made up a mystical language because he ate too much cheese late at night. Wait, said Colin. We did prove that, right? We did, breathed Tag. They stared at each other for rather too long. So the dig? Bella urged. The dig, said Colin, clearing his throat. Right. Well, we found it. Nellie was behind that part. She's the one who studied the book at the Eldritch Library when she was an undergrad. Brilliant mind. She discovered she could replicate the map, if not the language, by pricking holes in a sheet of blotting paper. So, off we went on our fool's mission, Tag went on. But once we started digging on the site, we found a bloody great tomb, right where the book said. Of course we weren't going to wait until morning once the door was clear. You weren't, Colin scoffed. You snuck out first. I don't think I did. There we were, anyway, inside the tomb, staring at the walls, lined with brass. Brilliant. And there it was, agreed Colin. The language of grotesque, just like in the glossary, all over the walls. All the proof we needed for our fat bonus from the Quinfields. But, Lionel started. Bella placed a hand on his sleeve to keep him quiet. Go on. 28 gargoyles, said Colin softly. You know the thing about the ancient pharaohs of the demon age? They loved stuff. They just really loved stuff. All kinds of things. One of them was obsessed with cats. Another was into jewellery with spirals on it. One of them was just trees. That's my thing, trees. Filled this tomb with 48 trees made from silver and gold and jewels. And numbers, said Tag. Almost every pharaoh's tomb uncovered in the last century has been full of some kind of themed collection. Food, pets, art. Made from metal, mostly. Gold, silver, bronze. The tombs in Apollonia, though, they're all about the brass. So many zinc mines, Colin and Tag said together, with the pleasure of knowing a fact. Bella had felt this way the first time she made friends at university who liked magical languages as much as she did. Well, not quite as much as she did. No one liked magical languages quite as much as she did. She was still irritated no one had ever mentioned the Quinfield hoax to her. That was exactly the sort of story she loved. When she was 16, precocious and desperate to fill her head with knowledge, she would have lapped up the tale of a demonic language so rare that hardly anyone even believed in it. But the numbers thing, said Tag, demons are superstitious. And pharaohs from the demon age, exceedingly superstitious. Almost always, those shiny objects kept in their tombs, divisible by 7. 7, 14, 21, 28, said Selwa. Is that why Charlotte was so sure that the 29th was significant? Good old Charlie, muttered Colin sadly. He turned to Bella suddenly. What about Christabel? Is she... We lost her 11 years ago, Bella said quietly. Illness. Oh. There was a pause. Bella smiled brightly at Tag. So were there 28 gargoyles in the Tomb of Brass then, when you entered? He snapped his fingers at her. 28. Until Nellie Bloody Tunbridge came stumbling in. Colin half chuckled. She was so mad at us. Just flat out lecturing us on what irresponsible layabouts we were. Yeah, said Tag, and they both looked very sombre. It was my fault, said Colin. We'd been... You understand, we were kind of punchy about the whole trip. We'd raised so much money for what had to be a nonsense quest, and then we actually found a tomb in the hillside... The mood in the camp was silly, said Tag. Reckless. There was a prank war, Colin confessed all at once. Stupid stuff. But when you have that many people who've researched curses and magical languages all stuck in one place, well, it got out of hand. Part of the reason Nelly was so stroppy was because someone had pranked her. Put a charm on her pocket watch, so it recited aloud every written word that she saw. That's quite an impressive piece of magic, considered Lionel. Yeah, said Colin, bitterly. I'm a genius. It was all very funny for the first day or so, and that would have been a good time to end the charm, but because I'm me, I took it too far. When we entered the tomb, that charm had been active for nearly a week, and Nelly was about ready to strangle me. It's not your fault, said Tag. Colin looked at the ceiling. Pretty sure that's not what you said at the time. Tag took over the story. So, when Nelly Tunbridge entered the tomb and saw the hieroglyphs, the watch began to read them out loud, proving the theory that this was a language belonging only to inanimate objects, to the fleshless and unalive. As the hieroglyphs were read aloud, they peeled off the inner wall of the tomb, forming a magical miasma around Nelly, and then they killed her, said Colin, refilling his whiskey glass. Cheers all. The unnamed pharaoh took over her body, Tag continued. Clearly he or she had the ability to use the grotesque words of power. We don't know why. Some long-lost gargoyle secret. But no longer Nelly spoke one of those words, and then we were dead too. Dead and haunting the Tomb of Brass, said Colin, staring at his whiskey glass. Is marmalade still a thing? I really want marmalade on toast. No, don't get up, Mrs. Teapot. He stood suddenly and walked off in the direction of the kitchen at the back of the house. So that's where you were all this time? Asked Selma Gardner. You haven't aged a day. Were you awake? Awake enough, said Tag. Couldn't see or touch anything, and a sense of time, well, we knew we'd been there a long while. We could see and hear each other, but no one could hear us. If we went long enough without talking to each other or seeing anyone, we would fade, I suppose. Then after the tomb was emptied, Apollonians aren't big on bringing tourists around to visit sarcophagi. Time stopped having any meaning. The fading happened more often. Occasionally someone would turn up from the ministry, have a look around. When there were humans in the tomb, we'd wake up again. We tried to stay sharp, keep each other sane. But what were we doing it for? As far as we knew, we were ghosts forever. He set his own glass down. And then you woke us up, Miss Hathaway. We're very grateful. If you'll excuse me, I'm just going to make sure Colin isn't drowning himself in a jar of marmalade. An awkward silence fell around the tea trolley as Tag Gardner strode away. He's so different, said his mother thoughtfully. I never really expected I'd get him back. I know it's been a long time, but how can he look the same but be a different person? We are our experiences, Mrs. G, said Lionel. Some transformations happen suddenly without warning, and others, well, would any of us be the same if we spent a quarter of a century haunting an empty tomb? And on that note, said Mrs. McCabe, rising from her chair, I'm going to leave you to your family reunion. There's nothing quite like the satisfaction of closing a very cold case. Thank you for your help, said Bella. And I'm sorry we lost the glossary. I'm not, said Mrs. McCabe with her lovely distant smile. Not every artifact has to be preserved into eternity, as long as it serves a purpose. Now I have more storage space for gloves and scarves. Bella saw her to the front door, and bid her farewell. It was strangely surreal to watch Mrs. McCabe pop up her lace parasol and walk away in a haze of afternoon sunshine. The last few hours had not felt like daytime events at all. When Bella closed the door, the bronze key hummed happily against her collarbone. She pressed her hand to it for a brief moment, then turned to address the hallway. The broken glass had been swept up, and most of the cursed objects were back in their usual places, more or less.
"You all did very well today," Bella told them. "I'm grateful for your help and support and your protection. I think we're all going to work together terribly well, don't you?"
The glass eyeballs rolled towards her in a way that felt reassuring rather than terrifying, which in itself was a kind of victory. Thank you for listening to Sheep Might Fly. This podcast was recorded on Palawa land. I acknowledge and pay respect to the Tasmanian Aboriginal people as the traditional and continuing custodians of Lutruwita, Tasmania. Sheep Might Fly is produced and edited by Andrew Finch. You can sign up to my author newsletter for updates. Follow me on Instagram, Blue Sky, or Threads at TansyRR. And if you like this podcast, consider supporting me at Patreon, where you can receive all kinds of bonus rewards, early ebooks, and exclusive stories for a small monthly pledge. See you in 2 weeks for the epilogue of Curse of Bronze.